Before Lord God made the sea and the land, he held all the stars in the palm of his hand, and they ran through his fingers like grains of sand. And one little star fell alone.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 6, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning we have Matthew Murray, Peter Felicia, and Michael Portantier. Matthew is the chief theater critic at TalkinBroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Matthew.
Hi, James.
Hello. Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at TheaterMania.com, also writes for the Newark Star Ledger and Masterworks Broadways, among many other outlets. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. And also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his work at NPR.org, also at followspotphoto.com. And also has written a book, Forbidden Broadway, Behind the Mylar Curtain. This week, we had Lost in the Stars over at Encores. And Matthew, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, Lost in the Stars is a 1949 musical by Kurt Weill and Maxwell Anderson that's based on Alan Paton's 1948 novel, Cry the Beloved Country. Well, it takes place in South Africa, and it's about a black preacher who travels to Johannesburg to find out what happened to the black son who was up there working, trying to save money for college. When he gets there, he finds that the son has not been quite as virtuous and effective in life as the preacher might want. He has fallen in with some bad people, and he has gotten a young woman pregnant. And soon after the father arrives in Johannesburg, the son is involved in the murder of a young white man who is connected to the village that he came from. The story is a little bit unusual here in that there's never any question about the son, whose name is Absalom, by the way. There's never any question about Absalom's guilt or innocence. Everyone knows he did it, including him, and he is looking to sort of redeem himself in his father's eyes by telling the truth about it rather than lying about it and saving his life as a result. So there's a lot of stuff in the play that deals with questions of spirituality, and the lead character, Stephen Kamalo, it's basically about a crisis of faith that he has as he's trying to reconcile his own beliefs and feelings for God with what's happening to his son up in Johannesburg. And I think it's a very, very powerful play. I have to be honest, I don't know the original novel at all. I've never read it, but my understanding is that the novel is even more so than the musical. And if that's true, then the novel must really, really be something. But the musical itself has just an outstanding Kurt Weill score. I talked last week about Knickerbocker Holiday. Well, this is as far as you can get from Knickerbocker Holiday in terms of style. It's as far as you can get from Knickerbocker Holiday in terms of everything except Kurt Weill's artistry, which is pretty much impeccable from show to show. The one song that everyone probably knows is the title song, which Stephen sings at the end of the first act as he's really kind of at his lowest point, trying to figure out what to do about his son. But there are a lot of really nice songs in it. There's the opening number, The Hills of Ikopo, which is sung by a call and response leader, who in this case is played by Quentin Earl Darrington, whom a lot of our listeners may remember from Ragtime. In fact, the interesting thing about the score is that it's kind of divided up into two parts. There's the quote-unquote traditional tribal sound of the leader's songs that really kind of convey the more cosmic and universal natures of emotions and what's going on behind the story. And then there are the character numbers themselves, like Thousands of Miles, which Chuck Cooper sings about his relationship with his son, and The Little Gray House, which is kind of a little charm song that he sings. There's a sexual innuendo song called Who'll Buy that takes place at a fruit market, which all the fruits seem to refer to other things, and Trouble Man, which is sung by Absalom's girlfriend, the one who's carrying his baby, and so on. Really, and there, in fact, there's a wonderful song called "Cry the Beloved Country" that the chorus sings, that really kind of sums up what's going on. It's a wonderful score, and it's a very powerful show. But the problem with what they're doing at Encores, and I guess they'll have finished it by the time you hear this podcast, is that, like, in my opinion, and I know not everyone agrees with this, but like Follies, which they did a few years ago, Lost in the Stars is a very complex, emotional show, and it's not something that you can really do justice to in like 35 hours of rehearsal time and with a top-down book. This, I think, has to rate as one of David Ives' worst adaptations of a musical's production script, because really the story is just outlined in neon letters. There's no subtlety to it. There are lots of little things that don't really make sense or fit together, and characters seem to exist for no reason and then disappear for no reason. It's really tough to watch for that reason. And then the other problem with it is that, as much as I love Chuck Cooper, I think that he needed either more time or was miscast or something, because he did not really do justice to the score. I didn't get from him the real sense of passion and anger and just sort of confusion as his view of the universe is falling apart. And the title song especially just needs to be this absolute cry to the heavens for understanding and trying to make sense of all the terrible things that are happening to him. And Chuck Cooper sang it prettily. And that was about it. I got no sense of what was happening in the story or in the character from him. And yeah, it's a concert. You're supposed to look beyond all that. But what flies in something like Pardon My English or The New Moon, for example, both of which, by the way, were directed by Gary Griffin, who also directed this, those techniques don't work in Lost in the Stars, because I think you can't separate the power of the music as a composition from the emotional power that it has to have when you sing it. There's no boundary between the two for me. If you don't have one, the other doesn't make any sense. And that was the experience I had here. It's really great to hear this in played by a full orchestra, which, for the record, is 12 pieces. This is definitely one of the smaller Encores orchestras that they've had, but this is apparently the full orchestration. I can't imagine what it must have been like to see a musical in 1949 with 12 pieces. Of course, Kurt Weill was as good as an orchestrator as he was a composer, so this sounds better than a lot of musicals today that have twice as many instruments. Not that there are very many of those, but that's a whole other subject. But so it's expertly done from a musical standpoint. The singing is wonderful. There's one particular debut from a young man named Jeremy Gums, who sings a song in the second act called Big Mole that you can't really figure out from the book what he's singing about, but he does absolutely terrifically by it. He's maybe like 12 years old or something, and it really is the showstopper of the evening. But I don't think it should be. I think that the songs Chuck Cooper sings really need to be where the heart of the evening is. And for me, the problem with this Lost in the Stars is there just was not enough heart to go around.
I liked it substantially more. I will admit that Matthew must have a point about Chuck Cooper not being as prepared, because he seemed to rely on the script more than anybody else on that stage. But nevertheless, certainly the cheers he got at the end of the first act for singing Lost in the Stars indicated that he pleased a lot of people. I thought the music was pretty well served. Yes, there are only 12 pieces, which is a bit of a surprise. One has to wonder if Encores chose it because they could save on musicians, just as I wondered years ago when they did no strings, that they wouldn't have to pay strings. But yes, that is the original orchestration. This is not a show for the tired businessman. It's amazing that it ran as long as it did back in 1949, which was about 6 months' time, a little more. And that's pretty astonishing for a show that's virtually unrelentingly grim. There are very few laughs in this show, very few, probably the fewest of any Broadway musical. And not only that, but I do think that's one of the reasons, not to take anything away from the young man who sang Big Mole, but Big Mole is essentially an 11 o'clock number. originally, the way it was done is that the young man was playing with his friends and sang the song. So you had other kids on the stage. You don't have them here, again, all in the cause of economy. But I think one of the reasons the kid got a great hand, and I hate to say this to indicate that he wasn't worthy, he was terrifically worthy, but it's because the audience had had nothing like it for so long. The closest thing, as Matthew indicated, was that Who Will Buy song, which is full of double entendres, you know, how do you like my melons, that type of thing. That's not an actual lyric, but you get the point. I do think that was part of it, that it's a terrific song, and it's infectious, and it's hard not to be caught up in it. What's also interesting to me is when Matthew talks about David Ives' adaptation, I do feel that he corrupted one thing. There's a scene where Stephen, the father, tries to find his son, and he finds his son's girlfriend, Irina, a name that will probably come up later in this broadcast. So he meets Irina, and he starts asking her some tough questions about her life, and he finds out that she's been married quite a few times already. And, of course, this doesn't please him because he's a religious man. That's his vocation and occupation. So he asks her a lot about this, and he says, would you, if I came on to you, in essence, would you go with me? And she's very embarrassed by it. But in the original script, she eventually says, yes, I would. And David Ives cut that out, probably to have us have more sympathy with Irina. But nevertheless, for the record, whether you think it's a good idea or a bad idea, the fact remains that it did distort what originally was in that original script, because she eventually does say, yes, I would go with you, and she doesn't do it here. What's also fascinating to me, Matthew mentioned that it was a 1948 novel and a 1949 musical. Think about that. Look how quickly it got on. Look how quickly they wrote it. It doesn't seem like a rush job by any stretch of any imagination. It is a complex work. This is not a conventional Broadway musical in another sense. The songs never, I think maybe once, twice, but I can't think of one, move the action forward. They're mostly lovely lyrical pieces, very poetic. That was what Maxwell Anderson did. It's a completely different experience from any Broadway musical that one can really see these days, and certainly a very different experience from what one could see in the 40s and early 50s when it played. So, as a result, I hope that everybody cherished the opportunity to go see it, because we always complain that Encore does shows like The Pajama Game and Bye Bye Birdie and shows we've seen a million times that we don't need to see again. This was one that doesn't get shown very often. I did see the 1972 revival, which lasted only 39 performances. I didn't see it here. It tried out in Boston, and that's where I saw it. My point is that in about 60 years, New Yorkers have had, allowing for previews, about 45, 50 chances to see this show. That's not much. That averages up to less than a performance a year. So I hope the people took the opportunity, because I know that the lesser encore shows, the lesser known ones, I should say, do not do as much business as the Bye Bye Birdies and the Pajama Games. Whether we like that or not, that is the reality. Juno was not a high grosser. Music in the Air was not a high grosser. And I suspect this one was not either. But if we want Encores to do the odd title, and everybody's always saying, Encore should do, and then followed by obscure musical title. If we want that to happen, we have to support it. So as a result, I hope people got out there and saw Lost in the Stars.
Peter, I don't want you or the listeners to get the wrong idea. I wasn't trying to suggest that Chuck Cooper was not prepared. I was trying to say that I think that the nature of Encores makes it difficult for anyone to give a really powerfully dramatic show like Lost in the Stars the attention and the detail and the depth it needs. I had no problem with Chuck Cooper's professionalism. I thought that, in fact, actually, I didn't notice what you did about him being on book more than anyone else. If you saw that, that would make total sense, because he certainly has a lot more to say and sing than anyone else. The person I noticed having to rely on the book the most was Daniel Jarrell, who plays the white father of the man that Absalom kills. But I mean, again, that doesn't bother me. I know that when I go to encores, I'm going to see people looking at scripts. I don't care about that. But I didn't want anyone to think that I was saying Chuck Cooper wasn't doing his job. I think he was probably doing the absolute best he could have done under the circumstances. But if you have a week or less to try to figure out the intricacies of a character like this and of a show like Lost in the Stars, it's going to be real tough no matter what. And that's what I was trying to get across. So if I did not make that clear, I apologize.
I'm actually happy to hear you both taking David Ives to task, because I guess he's, you know, now established as the de facto person at Encores who adapts or cuts or whatever the word is, the books. But he's made some highly questionable decisions over the years. And now, Peter, you're saying he's made this really kind of significant change in the book to Lost in the Stars. So I you know, I wish that maybe they would give that job to someone else at least some of the time, because I just don't know if he's doing it that well.
You know, Michael, it's interesting that you're bringing this up, because last week we spent a lot of time talking about the New York idea, which has problems along these lines. And I believe that Peter has since seen that, and we'll be discussing it later. But yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I can't catalog every single thing that David Ives has cut or changed over the years. The one I remember is one from The New Moon, in which he rearranged the words of a line late in the show to make it a critique of the Bush administration that it was not originally intended to be. And so he does have a habit of doing that. Now, I don't think all of his adaptations or cutdowns or what have you are necessarily bad, but this one to me really seemed to gut it of a lot of its guts, you know, for want of a better word. And that's not always the case, but this one, I mean, really, the whole thing is less than 2 hours long. It's hour 57, 58 minutes or something like that. I've seen Encore's concerts that are 2:15, 2:20 even, maybe 2:30 for that matter. I think that if he had put in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes more of dialogue, I don't think anyone would have noticed, and I think it might have helped the show go down better.
I have to say I felt it was too speedy, too. This is not a show that really relies on a slick staging that will get it over with as quickly as possible, you know, keep it moving. It's not that type of show. It's a mood piece. And as a result, I think this is one that could have been done as is, and it would have come in at a very decent length. Perhaps they don't want to overtax their people, and that's another story entirely. But nevertheless, this is a show that needs a little bit of breathing room and space to resonate. So the fact that it was almost over before it began, and because both acts were very short, I felt that was shortchanging it a bit.
Well, I do think that they should revisit the whole question of how the books are adapted and who adapts them. I think that would be a very good thing for Encores to do. I mean, recognizing the fact that I understand why they do it, and you know, it is a concert; it's not a full production. But yes, you know, sometimes just cutting out one line from a show can really damage it. For example, so I just wish they would revisit that.
So that was the City Center Encores performance of Lost in the Stars. And if you're listening to this, you've missed it, because it only happened. It's closing today? Is it?
Yeah, tonight's last performance.
Tonight's the last performance. Next on our agenda, we have Three Sisters, Chekhov's play that's running off Broadway right now. Peter got a chance to see that. Why don't you tell us, Peter, what you thought?
I like Three Sisters immeasurably. It's certainly one of my favorite plays. So it was, whenever I have the opportunity to see it, I do. It is, in fact, the play, aside from A Christmas Carol, which I have to see every year at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, it's the play I've seen the most. So I'm always up for a new production of The Three Sisters. This one I thought was certainly in the first division of the 16 productions I've seen. The main difference of this production for me was Maggie Gyllenhaal playing Marcia, because Marcia is the least satisfied of the three sisters. She's the one who got married a little too early to her teacher, who seemed to her, she says, the most exciting, brightest man in the world when she was a student. And now she doesn't think he's so terrific anymore. Usually, Marcia is pretty dour, and it takes a lot to get her to even smile. This actress plays it in a much lighter way. And I'm still not sure if it works or if it doesn't. I have to say, it almost seemed like a musical comedy performance to me. Not that she was singing, not that it's a musical, but it seemed to me that it was almost that type of performance. She was actually bubbly at most times. Now, one could effectively argue that there are people who are miserable who put on a happy face and certainly try to be the best they can be under the possible. Under the circumstances. So in a way, it was refreshing, and in a way, I didn't think it had the gravitas. I'm still not sure how I feel about this performance. So it was also interesting to see her play opposite her real-life husband, Peter Sarsgaard, as Vershinin, playing lovers. That's always interesting to me. I was recently writing about Raisin in the Sun and how Ossie Davis came in to play opposite Ruby Dee when Sidney Poitier left, and you know the dynamic between a real couple and a stage couple, I think you do get something extra there. So I thought their scenes worked very, very well. I like that quite a bit. And I also thought that for all the talk about how they're in the middle of nowhere, at least they're living well. It's a very nice set design. So I like that quite a bit too by Walt Spangler. So that I liked very much. I have no problem with Jessica Hecht playing Olga, the sister who, well, you know what they say about having greatness thrust upon you. The best greatness she can get is becoming headmistress, even though she doesn't want it. It is thrust upon her. A school teacher who finds herself in an executive position as time goes on and doesn't want it. I also like Juliet Rylance very much as Irina. Playing the woman who early on, young, says, I want to work. That's what I want to do. And then she works, and then she doesn't like it very much and wishes she didn't have to. And the irony is she has always held out for the most wonderful man in the world, that someday she's going to meet the most wonderful man in the world and she's going to fall in love, and that doesn't happen. And she winds up becoming engaged to a man that she doesn't love, but this is the best of the bunch, and that's what it's going to be, except it isn't. She doesn't even get that much out of life. So that's very powerful as well. I like Louis Zoritch very much as Fedotic because he aged very well. This is an old man at the beginning of the show, and he has to get older still. And I thought that was impressive. But every production of Three Sisters has to be judged by its Natasha. And here we have Marin Island doing it. By the way, let me interrupt myself here to ask. Mamie Gummer was supposed to be in this production originally. Do we know who she was playing?
I can try to look that up.
That's all right. No, don't worry about it. I just thought you might know. But I know she was in the original press materials that she was going to do it. And I wondered if she was going to play Natasha. But anyway, Marin Island is here. And this is a performance that's been very controversial. I always judge Natasha by her very first scene, where she comes in and Olga chastises her for wearing the wrong belt. She criticizes the belt. She says that you don't wear a green belt with that outfit. And what's so wonderful is Natasha says, well, you know, it's not really green. Yeah, and what we see there is the beginning of who she'll turn out to be. You know, she will wind up crying in that scene before it's over. She will feel inferior, but she does stand up for herself there at that moment. And we do see a bit of backbone that will turn into a very rigid backbone as the play continues. So that's very interesting to me. And I thought that she did that scene very, very nicely in standing up for herself. Many people have criticized her for being much too shrewish, but I didn't feel that way. I thought she was fine. I liked her quite a bit. And then her husband, Andre, is certainly very nicely played here by Josh Hamilton. There's a different interpretation here at the end of the first act as well, which I think is a viable one. Usually when I see Andre at the end of the first act, when she's in tears because she feels that the family doesn't like her, usually what happens is that he proposes marriage to her to calm her down, to just get her out of this terrible veil of tears. And what happens in this production is you really see that he loves her. And I thought that was a very different and valid and probably maybe what Chekhov had in mind in the first place. So I like that very much. I've also heard some criticism because it's a bright and breezy translation, very colloquial. Yes, indeed it is. It didn't bother me. So maybe I found it refreshing after 15 other trips to Three Sisters. But nevertheless, I think it's a worthy Three Sisters. I don't think it's perfect. I think it's hard to get Three Sisters perfect. But nevertheless, I liked it, and I'm glad I attended the Sweet 16th production.
Next thing we'd like to talk about is we talked briefly last week about The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore, but Peter and Michael have had a chance to see it, so why don't we have them weigh in? Michael, why don't you start us off with The Milk Train?
Well, yeah, I'd like to say that I actually I don't think it's a very good production at all, but I still enjoyed it because I had never seen or read the play previously in any form whatsoever. And I was surprised to find it that I thought it was a much, much better as a play than I ever thought it would be, because I think it's generally agreed that a lot of Williams' later work is just not... Well, it's very problematic, let's put it that way. But this one, I found the characters very interesting and the dialogue very compelling for the most part. So I was glad that I got to see it. It did strike me that this is one of those examples that I often give of how whenever the Roundabout has a show that they don't think is going to be, well, whenever they have a show that's either not commercial because of the content or who's in it, or a show that they think is just not very good, they tend to put it in the Laura Pels. And this, there, although there have been some notable exceptions to that rule, this one is not one of those exceptions. It's just really not a very good production. Olympia Dukakis is terribly miscast in terms of age and type. Having said that, I still enjoyed her in this more than in anything I've seen her in on stage ever, because she tends to, it seems to me, make very odd choices as to what projects to take on, and the things that I've seen her in, the Broadway show Rose, she was in Prayer for My Enemy at the Public Theater. I saw her in another off-Broadway production, I can't even remember the title, but just really maybe a case where a person's talent is much greater than their taste in choosing material. This play, as I said, the play itself, I thought was really very well written and very compelling. And so I enjoyed watching her in this show, even though she is very miscast. Darren Petty was not quite right for the role of Christopher Flanders, this young man who's after her in one way or another. But I thought he did a good job. Edward Hibbert gives a very over-the-top performance as the Witch of Capri or Capri, which was originally written as a female role, but there is a precedent for it being played by a man in the film version of this piece, which is called Boom, and in which the role was played by Noel Coward, of all people. So, bottom line, not a very good production at all, but I'm very glad that I saw it.
Well, yes, Olympia Dukakis is very much miscast in this role. For one thing, she's much too old for the part. I'm not going to say how old she is, but I do think this should be played by a woman who's in her 50s, and that's not the case with Olympia Dukakis, an actress, by the way, who I have admired greatly, who I used to see a great deal in Boston when she was acting there as part of the Charles Playhouse Repertory Company. Her Mother Courage was spectacular way back then. I have a great fondness for Olympia Dukakis because she was somebody I knew way back when, but she's simply too old for the part. That said, she's tremendously game for it. She throws herself into it with abandon. And if she is too old for it, it seems that nobody's told her and she's unaware of it. And she feels that she can still play this 50-ish cougar. That's what she is in this play, who's really out for this young man. And it is pretty shocking, deep in the play, when they kiss for a substantial length of time. This is no peck. Now, two things come to mind immediately. In the 1966 revival of Annie, Get Your Gun, Ethel Merman was about 20, 25 years older than the gentleman who played Frank Butler, a guy named Bruce Charnel, who ironically enough died before she did because he was killed in a plane crash. But anyway, the director, Jack Sydow, whenever there was a scene where they were to kiss, he used to have them hug. So you never saw Ethel Merman kissing him. In the notorious movie Sextet with Mae West and Pierce Brosnan, there is a scene where he goes in to kiss her and the doorbell rings, and they do spare you that. That doesn't happen here. And again, it's pretty fascinating to see Olympia go at it and the guy go at it, and it really is as erotic a kiss as you could possibly get. But I don't think she's helped at all by the wig she's wearing when she tries to look younger. I thought she rather resembled Harpo Marx, and I think that was greatly unfortunate. Sure, it's not a great play. I'm sorry I didn't see it when it had its Boston tryout. I was very young. I wasn't working yet. I didn't have enough money. I remember being in Boston. I remember the bad reviews. Also, of course, there was a very famous production a few years on in which Tallulah Bankhead and Tab Hunter played the roles. That was supposed to be one of the great camp fests of all time and only lasted a weekend in New York. I didn't see that either. I did see the play once before in a stock production in Baltimore, Maryland, and, well, at least the first act of it. So this was the first time I saw it all the way through. It has bits and pieces of other Williams plays, better plays in it. So it is interesting, a word we always hate to use because it neither flatters nor condemns enough, but nevertheless, you know, it is interesting, I was glad to have the chance to revisit it. Looking back on it, I'm surprised that anybody said, you know, we got to dust this one off and do it. So as a theater goer, I was glad to see it. As Michael Wilson at Hartford Stage certainly has made a commitment to Tennessee Williams, but he may have been doing him no favors by reviving this one.
Matthew, any further thoughts to expound upon last week's?
I am surprised that they liked it as little as they did. My feelings are kind of the polar opposite of Michael's here. I thought that Olympia Dukakis was actually very good, although, and I thought the production itself was fine, but the play itself is not. It's let's say it's not on the level of Glass Menagerie or A Streetcar Named Desire. I didn't have the problems with it that Peter and Michael had. They certainly make some good points, but those things didn't really bother me. I thought that it worked and that Michael Wilson justified his kind of surrealistic staging. And the wig that Olympia Dukakis wore didn't bother me. I thought that it was supposed to look rather funny to show that she was really kind of disconnected from reality, which is a big part about what the play was about.
Sure. No, I don't disagree with that. However, that said, she does resemble Harpo Marx to me in that scene.
That's fine. I didn't see that, but I think that does speak to what Peter said about how it has bits and pieces of other Tennessee Williams plays in it, because certainly there's a very famous scene in the Glass Menagerie that's all about Amanda Wingfield coming out in a dress that's several decades out of date. And so I think that is one of the reasons that the play doesn't have the lasting popularity of Tennessee Williams' other works, as it does seem to be kind of a retread of the other things he'd done. But it's not, it certainly worked perfectly well for me, as well as any version of this play can work. Yeah, I doubt very much we'll ever see this version of the play again, since it was put together specifically for this production, and then I find it difficult to believe the Tennessee Williams estate will license this version of it. In fact, I don't know which version or versions they license, so maybe they will put it out. I honestly don't know, but it worked for me probably about as well as this play can work. And if that sounds like damning it with faint praise, then so be it. There's only so much you can do with this play.
Yeah,
I
think you are looking at the glasses half full, and I think that's that.
So Matthew is often known as our poly positive.
I do what I can.
So let's move on then to the New York Idea. Again, Matthew talked about it last week, but Peter got a chance to see it. So Peter, why don't you weigh in on this?
I like the New York idea quite a bit. I had never seen it before in any way, shape, or form. So if some of those reviews did indicate the fact that that David Auburn, not David Ives now, but David Auburn's adaptation of it wasn't The Sun and the Moon, I was able to judge it simply by the way it appeared on the stage of the Lucille Hotel, and that was certainly fine for me. This is an Atlantic Theater production, which is renting other spaces while its home is being refurbished. So this was a play that was a big hit way back in the turn of the century times. And it must have been hot stuff back then because it is about divorce. And in fact, what it is about is the New York idea of divorce, as the line in the play goes. The fact that it's considered much too quick a solution to problems. And that's what it's about. And I like that very much, that here we are seeing people having this issue, whether or not they should get divorced quickly, whether should they take the marriage seriously, how seriously should they take it, till death do they part. Those are the issues in this play. And because of that, this is a wonderful look back at the time when this was a big issue. And that's what I love about period pieces, that they can take us back to an era in which we did not live, and we are able to see what was on people's mind at that time. So I like that very, very much. And we also see people trying to do the best they can once they are divorced, because we have John Carslake, who's played by Jeremy Shamos, and his ex-wife, Cynthia, who's played by Jamie Ray Newman. And, you know, they don't hate each other at all. They still have fondness for each other, but they've made this divorce and now they're going to have to live with it. But way down deep, doesn't each of them really want to get back together? And yet, pride comes into play here. And as a result, they really can't admit that each of them wants to get back together. So that's kind of fun, because the New York idea of divorce, getting divorced quickly, because that's the solution now. That's what you do when you have a few fights. Maybe you do it a little too quickly. So that's very interesting, too. Now, Cynthia, by the way, is going to marry a very dull man. And Michael Countryman is very, very fine in portraying this dullness. That sounds like a strange compliment, but it really is one, that he has to play this. He's a judge, and he seems very judicial, and he's the type of guy who probably limits himself to one drink before dinner and that type of thing. You know, a very solid, I know how I'm supposed to behave guy, you know, that type of thing. So I liked him quite a bit, and he has no idea who Cynthia really is. It's just that they're going to get married, and they've made the decision, and that's all there is to it. It's the sensible thing to do. Well, good sense doesn't always come into play when people really have to get together now and forever. So I think that's very interesting as well. Cynthia, by the way, has a penchant for horses. She loves the ponies. And that turns out to be a very important element of the play, because horses will be involved in her, in some of the decisions she makes. I mean, she doesn't mind at the beginning, seemingly, to lose her previous husband, but she does feel bad that she lost the horses that go with them. And I do think that Miss Newman does a very nice job of showing her love for the horses. And in a strange way, it also suggests that she still has a love for the husband as well. So I had a very good time at New York Idea. This is the type of thing I wish that would happen more often. We get to see plays from way, 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 way back when. And even if it has got a spruce up from David Auburn, even if it's not quite what was seen back then, yes, would I prefer to see the original done? Yeah, sure. But this I thought was close to splendid. Oh, let me also mention Francesca Faradani, an actress I've seen before in New Jersey quite a bit, when she and, I don't know if they're still together, Stephen Wadsworth, her companion slash husband, I forget what it is, but that's Michael Countryman's ex-wife, and she has some great style in being this person who believes in anything modern is good. She's, to complicate matters in a way that you might expect, has also been having an affair with John Carslake, Jeremy Shamos, and there are ramifications that come there. So it's all very messy, and that's the fun of it. We've certainly seen a number of properties that deal with this situation. People who divorce too early, who really love each other. Mary Mary comes to mind, a play that I like very much from the 60s. The Philadelphia Story, too, would apply here as well. And those are sort of grandsons, granddaughters of this play. So I would recommend this very, very highly. And I do know that if I knew the original, I might feel differently. But given that I don't, I had quite a wonderful time at the New York Idea.
Matthew, Michael, do you want to weigh in on anything Peter said?
Well, I want to say that I do know the original, and I did not have as good a time as Peter did. Although, to be fair, I read the original after I saw the Atlantic Theater production, and it explained a lot about why I didn't have as good a time as I felt I should. I think that David Auburn messed with things he probably shouldn't have messed with and screwed up certain elements of structure and pacing that the original play takes for granted will just make it work, and I think they do, but the adaptation has a little bit too much fun kind of doing new things, and that doesn't help. I did, however, just want to share an email that I got from one of our listeners, a man named John, who told me that he saw a production at the BAM Theater Company directed by Frank Dunlop in 1977 that starred Blythe Danner, Rene Auberjonois, Rosemary Harris, Stephen Collins, Margaret Hamilton, and Denholm Elliott. He said that it used the original.
Cast.
Yeah, I know. It's great. He said that it used the original text and the reviews were generally excellent. And here's a quote from him: as one who was lucky enough to see it, it was utterly enchanting. So that was, you know, that was a while back, 34 years ago. But even back then, at least he and a reviewer for Time magazine, he sent along a link, thought that the play worked very well at that point. I don't know how much has really changed in the last 30 odd years that would make the play work less well, but maybe. So certainly I do agree with Peter insofar as I would really like to see the original and see how it plays today. Personally, I have a feeling it would play better than David Auburn's version, just because I think that the original Langdon Mitchell version reads better than David Auburn's version plays, but who knows? It's what ends up on the stage that matters most. And until I see that, it's really hard to say for sure.
All right. So let's move on to our next topic, which is Other Desert Cities. As we talked about in the last couple of podcasts, Michael and Matthew saw it, but Peter hasn't. So Peter did see it, but Peter hasn't commented on it. So Peter, what did you think about this?
It seems to be an odd thing to say, but I was reminded of the very famous Walter Kerr review of Neil Simon's The Star-Spangled Girl. It's one that Neil Simon, in fact, even came to appreciate tremendously. In one of his memoirs, he says he laughed like a seal when he read it, because he knew that Walter Kerr had a point, and that was Neil Simon didn't have an idea for a play this year, but he wrote one anyway. And that's the way Other Desert Cities struck me, as a situation that was of no particular interest or insight to me whatsoever. It was certainly fine in terms of its moving along and everybody in it I had no problem with, but I just didn't feel that there was anything of interest or anything new or anything that that could possibly come up that was going to surprise me in any way. But here was John Robin Bates writing a situation about someone's writing a book and people not wanting it published because it would tell too much about a family. And it all seemed very familiar to me. So that's about as much as I have to say. I mean, the less said, the better, as far as I'm concerned, about Other Desert Cities, which I found sit-throughable and nothing more. I don't know how you guys felt, though. Did you like it?
No, not particularly. I talked about it at a much greater length than you did, but basically, I think we agree. One of the problems that I expressed with it, and I would be interested to hear if you have the same feeling, is that the play seemed to want me to sympathize with the daughter, who's played by Elizabeth Marvel, but I wanted to sympathize with the parents because I thought that the daughter was being really not very nice to them because they were basically saying, "Listen, can you wait until we die before you publish the book? It would really mean a lot to us." And she's saying, "Like, no, I really need to do this now for myself." And I thought that was a very that didn't come across very well in the theater. Of course, the play got a lot of very good reviews, so the three of us seem to be in the minority here. Yeah. But I don't know what else to say about it, really.
Well,
I don't want to dwell on it.
Yeah.
Well, Matthew, as you know, I had major problems with it too. But I do think that maybe you're wrong about that one thing. I don't think that John Robin Bates's goal was necessarily to make you sympathize with the daughter character over the parents. I think he was trying to present both sides of it. I think maybe initially you're supposed to think that you're supposed to sympathize with her, but then as it goes on, it becomes more complex. So in that respect, I thought it was, I thought the characters were well written. I just felt that the contrived is the word I used. And
there's something to be said for contrived. And I'm going to ask both of you guys, when there was all this talk about the book, did you feel at the end of the play that book was going to go into that fire or was going to be thrown in the air and all the pages were going to spread all over the stage? I thought all the pages were going to go everywhere. My girlfriend Linda thought that it was going to go into the fire. Did you see either one of those endings coming?
I wouldn't say I saw it coming, but I wasn't remotely surprised when it happened.
Right, yeah.
The only way that they could have made it better is if when she threw the pages into the air, some of them went into the fire by accident.
I'm surprised
that they didn't do that, actually.
Yeah.
That kind of wraps up our reviews section. We have a few little tidbits of news. We have Christy Brinkley, the Uptown Girl, going into Chicago. Michael, what do you think about that? Did I catch you off guard?
Well, I mean, it's hard to answer that. I mean, I don't know if any of us can even begin to prejudge, you know, how she might be in it, because what have we actually seen her do? You know, it might be in this tradition of, and this goes back to the discussion we had a few weeks ago, the idea that Roxy Hart, like Sally Bowles in another Candor musical, Cabaret, is supposed to have no talent. And that does make the story more interesting, but how is that transmitted into, a Broadway production? I'm not saying that I necessarily completely disagree with that, but it is an odd way of looking at it, or an interesting way of looking at it.
The producers of Chicago, Fran and Barry Weisler, have yet again found another way to get Chicago into the news again and sell tickets, which is, I guess, great for Broadway.
What it's about, right.
Yeah, great for, you know, that's their job, putting butts in seats, and that's what they're doing with Christy Brinkley, and it's...
I'm waiting for Claudine Lauger to come in. She's a minor celebrity of the 70s who had a couple of recordings, and she was actually involved in... I'm not saying she was guilty. I have no idea what happened, but no, she was involved in someone's questionable death, and it took a lot to keep her out of jail. Whether she was innocent or guilty, I don't know, but nevertheless. We might see her as Roxy Hart. It would have been certainly good stunt casting once upon a time. So who knows what's left.
But, wasn't there talk of Amy Fisher going in? Didn't someone suggest that?
It certainly was suggested. all these names from the past, huh? Yeah, so...
I kind of feel as though if we see Kathy Griffin get cast in the show, we could just about wrap it all up.
Yeah. Well, they're doing what they wanted. They got us talking about it, so that's pretty good. We only have about a half year to go before Chicago outruns the original production of A Chorus Line, which is really fascinating, given the fact that Chorus Line wiped the floor with it back in 1976 at the Tony Awards.
Yeah.
Chicago got 11 nominations, didn't win one of them, but it is strangely having a type of last laugh now, and that's pretty impressive.
Speaking of cast changes, we have a new cast coming into the Addams Family. Michael, you want to do part two on that?
Well, I don't have the full list in front of me, but I know it's that Brad Oscar is coming in as Uncle Fester, and I would think that would be a perfect part for him. That would be, I mean, I really didn't like the show at all, but that would almost be enough to get me to want to go back and see it again. And Heidi Blickenstaff, whom many of our listeners know from title of show, is going in the Carolee Carmello role.
I have the Theater Mania article in front of me. It says Heidi Blickenstaff, Adam Gruber, Brad Oscar, Rachel Potter, and Jesse Swenson. And that's on top of Roger Rees that was previously reported that he's going to go into.
Right, right.
I think they'll run as long as Danielle Derrière ran in Coco. I can't imagine that it's going to continue at any rate. Yeah, I can't imagine that this was a good idea.
Peter, do you think perhaps they'll bring back Matthew Broderick and and Nathan Lane to see if they can extend it?
Yeah, Matthew Broderick would have been a better choice simply from the vantage point of he's a name. But I think you really have to get an analogous name. And there must be some actor who needs the work who could come in who has a better name. This was the same mistake made with that other Nathan Lane musical, that they just did not bring in famous people. And as a result, the producers suffered. Some may say, for God's sakes, it ran 6 years. How much did it suffer? But commensurate with those reviews and those Tony Awards, it really should have run longer. And it would have had they had real top-notch names. I'm not saying Roger Rees isn't a marvelous performer. He might be terrific in the part. All I'm saying is the tourists come to town and say, who? And that's the problem they're going to have.
But Peter, at the risk of stating the obvious, I think maybe there's good reason why that didn't happen in both cases. In the case of the producers, I think that people were so terrified at the thought of taking over for Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick because the show was such an incredible success with them in it. And the first attempt to replace Nathan Lane, as you recall, was apparently a tremendous disaster when Henry Goodman didn't even open. So I think that, you know, I mean, people like John Goodman were mentioned and people like that. Jason Alexander did do the role in L.A., I believe. I'm not sure.
Yes, he did.
But I think that's what happened there. And in the case of the Addams Family, it's a little bit of that, but also the recognition among many people that the show is really not very good at all. I think that might be why. I mean, Antonio Banderas was mentioned. He would be the best Gomez possible that I can think of, but I think he might be reluctant to do it for those two reasons.
Yeah, sure. You certainly have a better point in terms of the fact that at least the producers was a heralded hit and certainly an iconic role that everybody knew about even before the stage producers happened, thanks to the Zero Mostel characterization in the film. But yes, that was a tougher act to follow in many ways. But still, aren't we in tough economic times? Isn't there some famous actor out there who's sitting at home tapping his foot waiting for the phone to ring? Isn't there one? And under those circumstances, wouldn't he be grateful to make a Broadway comeback? I think that would be something that would be quite fine for so many people. I just have a feeling that... I've always had the feeling that Mel Brooks simply didn't want to pay the money to have stars come in, that he felt the show was the star and he could get away with it. And, you know, again, 6 years, whatever it was, I mean, sure. You know, I mean, certainly The Producers still ranks as one of the longest running shows in Broadway history, but I still believe they could have got much more out of it had they brought in people that everybody had heard of. Nothing against Fred Applegate, who's a very good performer, but when I saw Fred Applegate's name above the title in The Producers, I thought, maybe this is Mr. Applegate from Damn Yankees, who, you know, made some sort of deal to be able to get in the show. Because how else does a guy named Fred Applegate get his name over the title of a musical on 44th Street? This doesn't mean he's not worthy of having that honor. All I'm saying is that I don't think the public knows who he is. And I don't think the public knows who Roger Rees is. It's not particularly. Not in the way they know Nathan Lane.
Well, Peter, I agree with you about that. I mean, it's been a long time since Cheers was on the air, and I think that that's probably what Roger Rees is best known from. And I just want to point out before you go on that eventually, and I think that you were one of the very few people to actually point this out, eventually the producers stopped putting any names over the title at the St. James. I don't know if Fred Applegate was the last one, but he must have been among the last, because eventually it just said The Producer was the new Mel Brooks musical, and there's no one over the title at all.
Well, it remains to be seen. It will be interesting whether the I mean, until now, I believe the Addams Family has been doing very well. How much of that is because of Nathan Lane and B.B. Newworth and the combination thereof, or separately, and how much of it is just due to the sheer name recognition of the property?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Didn't grosses fall terribly when he went on vacation?
Yes, they did.
So that's an indication that, yeah, maybe it's at least he at least had a major contribution to the box office.
Well, I guess it's empirical. We're going to get to see. We will get to see the results soon.
We will.
But insofar as I was thinking, when Peter was saying, isn't there one actor at home somewhere with his feet up? And I have one answer for you, a one-word answer. Mm-hmm. And the answer is Hasselhoff.
This was a one-word answer. I'm thinking Cher, Madonna. I'm saying, who's he?
Streisand.
I could see Cher playing Morticia, actually.
Yeah.
No joking.
Well, they'd love to have her, too, needless to say.
That would keep the show running at capacity.
Goodness, if I could turn back time.
And yet, Cher, when she was very, very popular, starred in a Broadway play called Come Back to the Five and Dine, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, which I think has one of the best first acts in theater history. A terrific cast. Sandy Dennis was in it too, I believe, and Karen Black was in it. It was a very starry production back in the 80s, and it closed very, very quickly, even with Cher in it. So, but yeah, time has passed, and certainly there would be. And Cher in a musical is a very different thing from Cher in a straight play.
Right.
So moving on, we have a balancing act happening here. On one side of the balancing act is Michael Riedel on his discussions of Spider-Man and repeated writing about it in the New York Post. And on the other hand, we have Michael Riedel and his repeated writings for the Book of Mormon, which is coming to Broadway soon and get an extraordinarily large amount of support and buzz from Michael alone. We've talked about it before. I know that Matthew is looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. I guess we're all looking forward to it. But it's astounding. Just the group ticket sales presentations and things like that. Is this going to be too unpolitically correct, or is it too early to say?
Well, James, I think it's really too early to say, but I just want to say something. You're right that I have said in the past that I was looking forward to seeing the Book of Mormon, but after a Michael Riedel column, I think from this past week, maybe Wednesday, in which he talked a little bit about the specifics of the show, I'm looking even more forward to it, and I will tell you why. That's because he says that Matt Stone and Trey Parker made the explicit choice to not make it about making fun of musicals, and that had been my fear. That it was going to be a lot like the producers and other shows like that that use the musical form to mock the musical form. And according to Michael Riedel's column, that's not what they have in mind at all. There's not going to be anything traditional about it, but it's going to be a traditional book show insofar as it's going to tell a story using the form as the way the story is told, but not, you know, necessarily calling attention to the way that it works and saying, well, isn't this stupid and all that, which is something I know that Peter hates and that I most certainly am not fond of under like 99.9% of circumstances. So I think that's a good thing. And certainly anyone who is familiar with South Park and particularly the South Park movie, which I think is one of the best animated musicals of the last 30 years and perhaps longer, knows that Matt Stone and Trey Parker do know musical theater pretty well. And so this choice doesn't surprise me, but it certainly makes me even more anxious to see something I already needed no prodding whatsoever to be excited about.
Well, it's going to be interesting, too, because if we do hear that this famous C word is going to be in it quite a bit, I wonder how that's going to affect business. Now, a couple of things I'll say on that. First off, the F word has certainly lost its power. My buddy Mark Grossberg was talking recently about he was reading a biography of Frank Sinatra, and the author now, this is not a quotation, the author in writing about a trip that Sinatra took said it was an effing long trip. He didn't say effing, by the way. He used the actual word. That it became simply an adjective that he used. That word has totally lost its power, so it's no wonder that they have to go to the C word now. Now, given the fact that so many theater goers and ticket purchasers are female, will this be a line that is one that they cannot abide? It's entirely possible that it will rub people women the wrong way. Yeah, it's interesting to me that this is the one term that women will not abide, that they will I've heard women say, "I'm a bitch." You know, they've done that, but they have certainly not referred to themselves with this word. And this one may pose problematic for the production in terms of ticket sales. It's not impossible that they may have outfoxed themselves by going to this word. But I understand. What words are left? You know, how can you shock anymore? You can't shock with the F word anymore. So you go to the next one. But it is also interesting to me that there is no such analogous word for men. There is no word that offends men. If you want to use an analogous word, the obvious one begins with a P, the five-letter word. If any man is called that, it rolls right off his back. But if any woman is called the four-letter word beginning with C, it does not roll off her back at all. So we'll see how this impacts. It may be that women are better sports than I think they'll be. It may be that they'll say, it's just a musical, it's just a show, who cares? But we'll see.
Peter, I have to just say something here. You know, the thing about the Book of Mormon, that you're absolutely right that if this were basically any other play, it would play an enormous role. It would have the potential to play an enormous role in getting audiences to come see the show, because, of course, the majority of theater goers, or at least the people who buy the tickets, are women. But with Matt Stone and Trey Parker, the creators of South Park, behind this, I have a feeling that this is going to be a show that men, especially younger men, are not going to necessarily shy away from immediately. They might be the ones buying the tickets for their wives and girlfriends. So I think that this is one case, one extremely rare case, where the impact that it's going to have on female ticket purchasers is going to be negligible, because I don't think that they are the automatic first target audience for
I'm sure they're not. However, when you say that the men are buying the tickets for their wives, that means the wives are going to sit in that theater, and it's very possible that they will be much involved with poisonous word of mouth.
Of course.
And it may not. I have no idea, but I see something that could be problematic. If it does turn out that this show does not fly, and that this is the reason why, I'm not going to be surprised at all.
We'll have to see it in context, of course.
Of course we will.
I mean, I watch South Park, and I can't believe the vile, disgusting things they say, and I'm laughing like a hyena, because just something about the way it's set up, it is so brilliant. I will admit that the quotes from the lyrics for the Book of Mormon that I read, just reading the quotes out of context seemed just offensive and not funny. But I'm certainly going to wait until to see it in context. One, another thing that's so interesting to me is I just assumed that this musical was going to be a lot about the whole closeted gay aspect of Mormonism, because it's a musical about Mormonism. And maybe that is in there, but Michael Riedel has not focused on that aspect of it yet.
That's certainly not my impression of it at all, because Matt Stone and Trey Parker are both straight. They're both married. Anyone who's seen any of their shows know that they have a very heterosexual sensibility from that standpoint. So I actually don't think that's something that's going to play a big role in the show at all. They, as you probably know, but I'll just say it for the listeners who might not, they both grew up in Colorado around Mormons all the time. So this is something that they're very familiar with from personal experience. So I'm assuming that I don't know the exact plot of the show, but I'm assuming that it will deal a lot with doctrine and indoctrination rather than necessarily the closeted gay aspect of it, which is something that has been dealt with by a number of other performers, including Stephen Fales, who has not one, not two, but three one-man shows dealing with exactly that aspect of it. So if we don't see that in the Book of Mormon, I actually won't be surprised, because that's an area that Matt Stone and Trey Parker have never seen any particular need to travel. And I think that that's actually not a bad thing, because what else are they going to have to contribute to it? Probably not much.
Well, but I mean, I see what you're saying, Matthew, but they have certainly made fun of gay people in other contexts. And it just seemed to me that because this is a Broadway musical about Mormons, that was going to be touched on. And even if you look at the logo for the show, which I think is hilarious, that kind of image of a guy in Mormon garb, you know, with the white shirt and the short sleeve white shirt and the dark pants and the tie, just kind of like tripping down the street or like doing some kind of a leap. I guess I thought that was going to be in there. Actually, I thought it was going to be the major point in the musical, but apparently it has little or nothing to do with that from what we've read so far.
Yes, but nevertheless, there will be that aspect will come up if, at the very least, in a line or a song. It has to happen.
I don't know about that. I'm not sure.
Really? You think there'll be no reference whatsoever?
I don't necessarily see it happening. I really don't. I mean, they've stayed away from that completely in South Park. In South Park, on the occasions that they've shown Mormon characters, they devoted an entire episode about it to a Mormon family that's almost stereotypically happy and they like being together. It's possible that there'll be a reference to it, but if it does happen, I don't think it'll be any more than a line, because I honestly think that Matt Stone and Trey Parker are going to be aiming higher than that with the Book of Mormon. And yes, I said that they're aiming higher. I actually am one of the people who think that their level of humor actually is much greater and much more serious. It's a much higher level of comedy than what people normally associate with them. And I'm not saying there aren't reasons to say that they're into low comedy, because they do that too. But I think that they blend the two. And I think that dwelling on that, it will not happen. And even if it doesn't happen at all, I actually won't be surprised.
Well, I guess one reason I thought it would definitely deal with that is the whole Proposition 8 thing. You know, I mean, that's such a huge thing. And in fact, so that just naturally led me to believe that they would deal with that. And also, Matthew, I'm not sure what you're saying, but I don't think that would make it low comedy necessarily. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff to be mined in this whole incredible hypocrisy thing of the Mormon stance on homosexuality.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. It's hard to say. There's so much that we don't know about the show at this point. So.
Well, if I were the producers of Book of Mormon, I might want to get together with the producers over at Catch Me If You Can and say it's the perfect night out and the men can go over to the Book of Mormon and the women can go and see Aaron Tveit and Catch Me If You Can and be done with it, because I think that those are going to really be geared towards specific audiences. I think that just like Spamalot really geared towards that same market that Matthew was talking about, the South Park watching male fans, I think that Catch Me If You Can will probably be gearing towards the women on the other side. And they're pretty close to each other, so they could actually come in together, see the show, and go. I don't know
what else? You know, we can speculate. I mean, I don't know if anyone knows, but it is kind of interesting that Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman have been involved with South Park, heavily involved with South Park over the years. They are not working on this musical. They have another show. So I wonder if they're not, maybe they're just not working on it because they had another show and they were already busy.
Michael, their other show is Catch Me If You Can.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. But who knows? I mean, maybe they were approached, but Mark Shaiman wanted to deal more with the Proposition 8 kind of thing, and maybe Trey Parker and Matt Stone didn't. I mean, that's total speculation.
Sure, of course.
And finally, what we want to mention, the sad passing of Mary Claire Heron, who's a cabaret singer and performed on Broadway as well. Michael, can you say a few words about Mary?
Yeah, she really was one of the greats, not only as a performer, and she was wonderful as a performer. She had a really great retro style. She was a wonderful champion of the American Songbook. But also, as a scholar and a writer and a contributor to documentaries about great singers and great songs, really one of the best that we had. And she apparently was in a biking accident in Florida and just was on life support for a couple of days and then was taken off. Only 58, a very, very sad loss to the New York arts community, and just really rest in peace. I don't know what else to say.
Peter, had you seen Mary?
Yes. I remember one time she was hired to do a function for a group of business people. It was their big annual event. It was a group not unlike the Elks, the Raccoons, you know, that type of thing. And it was fascinating because she began singing and nobody was paying attention. And I've seen a lot of performers in this context, where they are singing to a crowd that isn't listening and they soldier on and do the best they can. She stopped and she said, "There's no sense in my continuing if this is the way you're going to be. Do you want to hear this music or don't you?" And everybody was so shamed. And it was really fascinating to see her make the crowd quiet that way, that she had too much respect for herself to be treated like this. And she made that very clear. She didn't use those words, but she made it clear. And, boy, did they settle down. And at the end, whoa, what a hand they gave her. They stood. It was fascinating.
That's great. Yeah, I've heard that she did that similar things more than once, and it didn't always work out as well as that. But yes, and she had a wonderfully wry sense of humor. Just really one of the most intelligent performers, I think, that we had. She has lots of great albums. So you guys, please check her out on recordings. That's the legacy that she left, among other things. So do check her out.
So very sad to hear of her passing. She was very young. All righty. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the front page, on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right below the logo, there's a button for subscribing in iTunes. That way, each and every time we have a new episode, it'll be automatically downloaded and you won't miss anything. You can also subscribe, actually, in the Zune Marketplace. Hear us through Stitcher Radio. You can hear us if you get the Google Android Listen application, or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you'd like to reach out and touch us, comment or otherwise, there's a feedback form on the front page of BroadwayStars.com. You can send us an email. Also on the show page, there's different ways for everybody to get in touch with all of us, including Facebook, Twitter, email, various different ways. So if you want to do that as well, you could give us a call at 646-873-7695 and leave a voicemail. And if you do, we may play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Matthew Murray, Peter Felicia, and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Have a great week.
Bye, everyone.